This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 20th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this we're going to look at some developments in the area of federal taxes. First, we're going to take a look at the Department of Justice issuing a proposed rule that would remove cannabis businesses from the loss of most business deductions under Section 280E. Left you bounce through a couple of references. We had talked about this a couple weeks ago, that this proposal was going through Department of Justice. Now we've gotten it where it's now been sent forward for publication. We'll talk about where that puts us in the process. We also have filing date relief issued for those who were impacted by Ohio tornadoes back from March. So we'll talk about how this effectively gives a retroactive extension to those in the affected counties in Ohio for both March 15th and April 15th deadlines. And even if you got an extension, there's still an advantage to having this relief in place. We'll discuss that briefly as well. And I suspect that most of you probably, if you were there, or had clients in the affected areas, went ahead and got extensions anyway. But this gives us a little more breathing room. We'll talk about that. Third, we'll talk about the IRS National Fraud Council spoke on employee retention credit exams at the ABA's tax section webinar that they had. Talk about what they're doing on exams, what material they're asking for, and other information related to employee retention credit exams. And of course, keeping on topic, we're also going to discuss that there was a lawsuit filed this week by a tax advisor who is attempting to force the IRS to start processing employee retention credit claims. This particular advisor was the advisor to the taxpayer, may remember, in December of last year we discussed, who filed a lawsuit to attempt to get the IRS to, or basically get the courts to order the IRS to not use Revenue Procedure 2021-20 when denying ERC claims. So a little bit interesting, but you know, we'll talk about that background. We also have the tax court lost its patience with a taxpayer who was raising frivolous claims and imposed a $5,000 frivolous claim penalty in addition to having the taxpayer lose on the basic matter in front of the court anyway. And I raise that because it is a little unusual to see the court actually impose that penalty. They tend to warn people about the penalty quite often, but in this case, they actually imposed it. Not the full penalty. If this guy comes back to court, he may find himself facing a more significant penalty. In fact, about five times what he got, you know, if they decide they want to keep raising it and believe he hasn't learned his lesson. So we'll see what happens there going forward. But just a reminder of the frivolous position penalty, if you decide to take something to tax court, it's meant there primarily to keep people from just going to tax court to delay payment. So let's talk about this new Department of Justice proposed rule that would reschedule marijuana to Schedule 3, and why that's a tax issue, which, by the way, it is. And they released a lot of documents on this. We're going to talk specifically about the proposed rule because that's legally what we need to worry about. But they also released a press release, a set of questions and answers involved with it. And we'll also have some references here to IRC Section 280E itself, we'll talk about, as well as some information from an article that appeared in Tax Notes Today back on May the 8th about the IRS's approach, because the IRS was questioned in a House hearing regarding, you know, what they would do, you know, the idea that justice was moving forward with this, you know, how would the IRS react? And the commissioner gave some information about that in front of the House committee. So what's happened now is they have formally announced a proposed rule that would move marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 as a controlled substance. And that's important because Schedule 1 items are subject to 280 Cap E and Schedule 3 items are not. So that's why from tax perspective it becomes important. Now, once this gets published in the Federal Register, as far as I can tell, it's probably going to be published in the coming week, there will be 60 days for people to submit comments, as well as a 30-day period during which individuals could request that there be a public hearing held on this matter. Normally, people don't ask for that because there'll be written comments come in, but in theory, they could. Now, that 60-day period is required for these. They're basically regulations, just like Treasury regs. So there has to be a 60-day comment period, after which the agency takes the comments into consideration and either decides to make changes and send out new proposed regs, maybe withdraw the regs, or decides to go ahead and publish them as final with or without modifications based upon the comments received. So we're at least 60 days, well, 60 days plus would be publication, at least 60 days away from them, from this happening. And I suspect we're further away than that from this going forward. So we'll take a look, see what goes on. Now, for income tax purposes, as I mentioned, the key impact involves Internal Revenue Code Section 280 Cap E, which is a relatively significant section, which if you are involved with any cannabis businesses, let's say you're in a state where some form of marijuana sales, may it be medical, may it be recreational, is considered to be legal under state law. And if you're working with any clients who do that, you know, are in that business, you know way too much about 280 Cap E, which is a major problem. Now, what that section says is, no deduction or credit shall be allowed for any amount paid or incurred during the taxable year in carrying on any trade or business if such trade or business or the activities which comprise this trade or business consists of trafficking in controlled substances. And then parenthetically said, within the meanings of Schedule 1 and 2 of the Controlled Substances Act, which is prohibited by federal law or the law of any state in which such trade or business is conducted. Now, as a practical matter, this is applied where the taxpayer can take a claim for cost of sales. If they sell the marijuana, the cost of acquiring that marijuana or growing that marijuana, if they're a producer, can be deducted from their gross income. However, you know, any other costs, and this is more significant, obviously, if you are a retailer, so if you're a dispensary, because a lot of your cost of sale is pretty simple for a retailer. They're what you pay the person, you know, to acquire the product, and the shipping on it is basically what you get to put in there, especially if 280 cap A unit cap rules don't apply. And as we'll briefly discuss, they don't apply right up until this rule goes out the door. Then we would have to worry about 280 cap A if the business otherwise qualifies. But we'll get to that in a second. So the idea here is if we can take this drug off of Schedule 1, move it to Schedule 3, it no longer would be considered trafficking in a controlled substance, because this would not be a controlled substance per 280 cap E's definition of that term. And as always, remind people, in the law, you can define anything to mean anything. So regardless of what you might think about controlled substances in other contexts, and despite the fact that, you know, it's still not decriminalized, so there are definite controls that federal law impose on Schedule 3 items, it nevertheless would not be a controlled substance for 280 cap E. Right? Please remember, when looking at the law, definitions are crucial. And you always want to make sure there's not an overriding definition before you assume a word means its traditional normal meaning. That's something always got to be aware of whenever you're doing tax, whenever doing anything looking in the law, you've got to remember that. Now, as I said, it does not make use of marijuana illegal, doesn't decriminalize it. It just moves it off the schedule that bars a deduction for income tax purposes to a business that's engaged in trafficking in this particular item. So that would be a major change. It's going to have a key impact on state legal cannabis businesses, right? A majority of states in the US now allow some form of sales of cannabis, which is contrary to the federal law, but they allow it. And the feds have not really been enforcing much of this, you know, their law on it. So we're in a weird situation. And the impact would be, as I said, because the old law that came in to reverse a tax court case that allowed somebody who I believe was trafficking in a bunch of stuff, maybe in a cocaine dealer, as I recall. But anyway, they got to deduct all their expenses, and Congress wasn't happy about that. You know, it was totally illegal what they were doing, but the court said nothing said you can't deduct the expenses just because it's illegal. And they didn't believe that a public policy rule should be invented to bar such a deduction, figuring Congress wants to bar it, Congress say bar it. That's how we end up getting it. Obviously, as things change in the marijuana arena, this became more of an issue. As I noted, there is a very, very big impact on dispensaries because most of their expenses are not cost of sales. So things like the what you pay the salary to the staff, utility bills, right? Rent. You know, basically everything else you're doing aside from cost of sales is going to be disallowed. Now, for producers, it's a lesser impact because as anybody that's worked in that in the area knows, for producers, you know, you start trying to find every justification you can for why these costs should go into production. And you're using the IRS's own case law against them, where they've attempted to go after producers of other things who have tried to keep things out of inventory for obvious reasons. So it's an interesting area. Be a little sad to see it go because, well, it's kind of a unique, oddball way of planning when you talk about this. But yeah, it looks like it might be going. There does not appear to be a lot of let's say right now, sympathy for continuing the current system. We've heard some various bipartisan arguments on this because, again, the states that have legalized this are, you know, it's not that red states don't legalize or red states do and blue states don't. It's that, yeah, we've had legalization on all sides, right? And as long as, now this is the UNICAP problem. As long as 280 cap is in place, 280A, the UNICAP rules, 280 cap A, one of the provisions in there is that it cannot make something deductible that would not have been deductible in the absence of 280 cap A. And so because of that, you don't use UNICAP to determine inventory for a marijuana business. However, once the law changes, once this goes off of Schedule 1 and to Schedule 3, then we're going to suddenly be faced, unless you get qualified for an exception, you know, under the TCJA small business exception, you're probably going to have to start capitalizing and doing the UNICAP calculations. So yeah, you know, that calculation will start coming into play again. If the law is adopted, we are going to be facing UNICAP rules. That's simply the way it works. Now, in a May 8th story, so with the first reports that this was going to be, you know, that this proposal was going to move forward, occurred right at the end of April. So I recall the story we talked about. The first one I saw was in the Washington Post, but a bunch of others came up shortly thereafter. It came out on April the 30th saying DOJ was going to do this. Well, it kind of made, and it quickly became clear it was an open secret that DOJ was going to do this. Nobody was keeping really that tight a lid on it. So by May 8th, you know, Commissioner Warfel, or May 7th, actually, Commissioner Warfel was appearing before a hearing of the House Appropriations, Financial Services, and General Government Subcommittee. And the question came up, you know, we understand this is moving. We understand that this would remove the marijuana from Schedule 1, Schedule 3. We also understand you're not doing this. But if that happens, it would definitely appear to have an impact on 280 cap E, which would mean, you know, what are you going to do about trying to figure out how taxpayers should move from the 280 cap E era to the post 280 cap E era for a cannabis business? And the commissioner indicated that they are looking forward to working with the cannabis community on helping to determine and develop some guidance in this area. So IRS is aware of the issue. They're aware that things are happening. They also have some concern, too, about whether or not, depending on if something else happens similarly, you know, will cannabis businesses still be unbanked for the most part because banks don't generally want to work with them? Or is that going to be changed as well? Will they Will there be other legislation that may allow them to set up bank accounts? So are they going to go from unbanked to banked, or are they going to remain an unbanked taxpayer, even though they can have these deductions? And as he indicated, that makes a big difference about how you deal with stuff. Because just simple things like getting payroll tax deposits are more complicated when no bank will take the money. So it becomes kind of interesting. Next up, we have IRS News Release 2024-141, issued on May 16th of 2024. And this news release grants relief for taxpayers who were subjected to tornadoes that began on March 14th, 2024, in certain counties in the state of Ohio. Now, as you may look at that going, well, come on, this is like 2 months after the fact you're telling us about this. And yeah, it is. And, you know, a quick response I got when I mentioned this, you know, was, well, wait, no, we got longer relief than this from from the extensions. And the answer is, yeah, but we'll talk about why, even though you probably have these returns on extension, if you've got a client who was impacted by this, this is still granting you some significant relief that will help you even for an extended return. So we'll talk a little bit about that side of it. Now, it covers individuals and households that reside or have a business in Auglaize. Sorry, who in Ohio, don't know your county names that well. Crawford, Dark, Delaware, Hancock, Licking, Logan, Mercer, Miami, Richland, and Union counties. And IRS notes that this could be expanded. FEMA controls the disaster areas, so if FEMA adds more counties there, they would be covered, but as of right now, that list of counties would be the ones that are currently covered for this. Now, this relief will push back most filing deadlines that fall between March 14th of 2024 and September 3rd of 24 to make them into September 3rd, 24 filing deadlines. So everything needs to be filed by that date. You know, so conceivably, if you had a due date of, let's say, June 15th for a tax return because you were a February fiscal year C corporation, you would still move that to September 3rd, right? So everything gets that relief as long as there is a due date in that middle period for filing a return. You'll be able to pick up the middle date. Now, they do give a list in the news release of some things that are specifically extended. But as I said, it does cover all deadlines in there. And when the IRS does this, they basically give the major things, the things that are going to impact probably 95% of people to get this relief. But they won't cover odd things like fiscal year ends and that sort of stuff. If you have a fiscal year end client, you need to check to see if their due date, unextended due date, would have fallen in between March 14th and September 3rd. So first they tell us this would apply automatically to any individual income tax returns and payments normally due on April 15th. Well, you know, that's gonna cover most any calendar year individual return. We'll have that covered. So the effective due date becomes September 3rd. And why is that important? Because, you know, like I said, hey, you know, my clients, they all got extensions. So, you know, what's the big deal? We already have until, you know, October 15th. Why would we worry about the September 3rd? You worry about September 3rd because, you know, if in fact your taxpayers are paying on that date, or, you know, or let's say as tax due on that date, then effectively they're treated as having paid the tax back on April the 15th. Same thing with filing the return. It takes place on April 15th. And of course, if your client didn't get an extension, somehow it got fouled up, you're still in a position of not being late. So there are advantages to this, if nothing else, getting out of interest and penalties, or generally the IRS view is going to be that since it's treated as if it was put in on April 15th and filed on April 15th, interest starts getting paid under the standard rules for a delayed refund. So that also comes in during this period. You should expect to see some interest. Also, you can make a 2023 contribution to an IRA or health savings account. If you're an eligible taxpayer in the disaster area, you can make an IRA or health savings account contribution all the way through September 3rd. Quarterly estimated income tax payments for individuals, there would have been, you know, a calendar individual, one due on April 15th, another due on June 17th. Those both go in September 3rd. And then a few days later, on September 15th, we have our third estimate. But, you know, everything gets delayed at that point. And I'm sure some client will ask, so you always tell them, look, if you want to just pay all three of the estimates on September 3rd, the IRS will definitely accept them, right? So, you know, if you don't want to have to do two back-to-back that quickly, some clients just find that to be a tedious, because especially if they're going down and getting things certified, tell them it doesn't bother you to pay it, you know, 12 days early, it's not going to bother the IRS. Also, quarterly payroll and excise tax returns that are due on April 30th and July 31st will also be due September 3rd. So we'll kick those back at that point. Calendar year partnership and S corporations returns. Now, this one's really interesting. They actually barely make it in, but because they were due on March 15th, they're now treated as if, you know, all the way through September 3rd. Automatic extension through that date. And then, of course, you know, probably, as I said, you probably have a September 15th extension already in your back pocket. But if not, you know, then you could get that extension as of that date. Also, calendar year corporation and fiduciary returns and payments normally due on April 15th would also be pushed back under this program to September 3rd. And exempt orgs, the ones that we just filed extensions for, will those also be treated as if, you know, September 3rd is May 15th. Now, as I said, the key issue is a return filed by that date and a return and a payment made by that date are treated as if they took place back on April, on April 15th, which is what makes it better than a traditional extension where you had to pay anything due at April 15th, right? You had to pay anything due at that date. So this is a little bit nicer than otherwise. As I mentioned, if somebody somehow didn't get an extension, right, you now discover, oh, they forgot to extend the return, individual return, we can still get an extension. But there is one caveat. The IRS systems are not set up to accept extensions, you know, beyond the normal date they should have been, you know, applied for. So don't submit these extensions electronically. In fact, your tax software probably balk at doing it. Rather, these have to be submitted in paper form. So be aware of that and what's going on there. Now, payroll and excise tax deposits have different relief and not really as good as the September 30 delay. In fact, in this case, you better figure it out, because it always happens this way, that any excise tax deposits or payroll tax deposits were going to have to be made much earlier. So presumably, you got them taken care of, because what we're going to get in this case is 15-day delay. So anything due on or after March 14th of 24 and before March 29th of 24, we're going to abate all penalties as long as the deposits are made by March 29th. So you want to make sure those were in by then. Obviously, at this point in time, you can't do much if they weren't. But if the client was late, remember that and keep this notice handy. The release also has information on other tax relief that may apply because of the disaster. They remind us that under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, while generally personal casualty losses, which has its own special definition that is not as broad as a lot of people assume, I just remind you of that because I've seen lots of people not understand what a personal casualty loss is. Remember I said earlier in the session or this program that, you know, you have to watch for definitions. Yeah, you want to go back to the actual code section here and take a look at the real definition. And if you take a look at there under 161, you'll find that personal casualty loss has a very specific definition that's not just something not used in trade or business. In fact, it's narrower than that. But in any event, in this case, if there was a personal casualty, let's say that your home was destroyed by the tornado and you have an uninsured loss, that's a personal casualty loss. It's a federally declared disaster, and there is relief in there. First thing, you'll be able to claim it, you know, and other provisions work to your advantage in the case of a federally declared disaster. They also remind you that qualified disaster relief payments are not taxable. So you want to make sure you keep track of that. You may also have even, you know, we've talked about this back in COVID, but the clue that certain payments by an employer to employees to, you know, assist them or reimburse them for expenses incurred due to the, you know, natural the disaster, federal declared disaster, are excludable from income. So that's also in play, and that might happen, let's say, if the employer's facilities were damaged, the employees are working from home, then you're back to the kind of arguments we had during COVID as to what extent could you reimburse them for any expenses they're incurring because they're now able to work from home instead of being able to work at your office due to the casualty and due to the emergency. And finally, retirement plan relief under Secure Act 2.0, right? We have now automatic relief for certain withdrawals from IRAs and employee plans. But I should add also, remember, the employee plan rules for the most part only work if the plan has been amended to allow for that. Yes, you have rules that would allow for more generous loan rules or allow for distributions, but your plan has to have been amended to take those into account. So don't just assume that, you know, your client can access that 401k until you actually take a look at the plan to see what really is going on. Next up, we have an article that was in Tax Notes Today Federal on May the 15th, 2024, and it was entitled Employee Retention Credit Auditors Are Digging Deep by Nathan Richmond. And this is covering the IRS National Fraud Counsel, Carolyn Schenck, who spoke on May 14th on the issue of ERC exams. Now, her presentation was to the ABA section of taxation webinar that was going on at that point. And what she noted was, in broad, the government is looking for substantiation to understand the nature of the business, its size, how it was impacted, as well as to make sure the entity is actually entitled to the employee retention credit. So this is in ERC exams. Right. So for that purpose, they're specifically asking for, as you mentioned, any records a taxpayer relied upon for conclusion that their operations were partially suspended by government order. Obviously, they are, I love it. She didn't even say suspended. You know, she said partially because that's where all the battles are. Actual suspension is probably pretty easy, and you'll carry that. The problem is, did you pay anybody? Partial suspension is where you almost certainly paid people. And we're going to get a fight over that. So I want to know, what did you rely upon? You know, what were your conclusions? How did you get to the answer that this worked? Right? You know, basically, what's your argument why the law should be interpreted to say that these facts that occurred to you count as a partial suspension? They also going to want backup, and that will include things, you know, as we'll talk about, you know, various things you have, like the government orders that you claim required you to shut down. Now, if you didn't go the partial suspension or suspension route and you went for reduction in gross receipts, they're going to ask you for records backing up the reduction in gross receipts. For that, obviously, you need both the base year, which is 19, that you're testing, as well as the period in the years that you're claiming the credits for to show there was a proper reduction of revenue. And prove that, and you need records to back that up. You need documentation of your qualified employees and what they were paid. So the payroll records have got to be there, right? You know, showing that, making sure you cut them off timely, you know, making sure that you understood who could and couldn't receive items, you know, that background they're looking for. Looking for relevant communications you had with employees or customers that helped to show what you were doing, how, you know, how this had impacted you. They're really looking for that, you know, as opposed to probably be bad if you found a order that told employees they had to report to office just like nothing happened. So be down here, work your standard hours, et cetera, et cetera. That would probably, and if you told clients, oh, my clients are customers, oh, by the way, no, you can come down here, no restrictions, we're not limiting anything, that's probably bad too. Conversely, if you told employees that they're going to have to stay home, they got to do these things, you started doing those sort of communications to, you know, that show a clear impact, as well as communicating clear impact to customers, those are probably better for you, right? So you're going to look at that from that perspective. They're also going to ask for copies of some previously filed tax returns. Basically, the 941s will be asked for, as will almost certainly the income tax returns for however this is being reported, looking at that background. Now, she also warned that if people don't provide this, and there is a question about it being provided, because again, a lot of businesses were sold this based on the everybody qualifies and not really doing much digging. And they were told that was clear and that's what the outfit said. You know, well, they may balk at providing all of this detail. You know, why do we need to provide that? You know, we're told by our advisor that everybody qualified for this credit, you know, and it's just automatic. So no, we're not going to show you that stuff. IRS will respond with summonses from to either the taxpayer or a third party, if need be, to obtain the information you're looking for. And obviously, the other downside is don't provide the information. Don't be surprised if the, you know, credit's just disallowed in full. That's kind of the obvious other side of that. So they're looking for that as well. They're also sending out now currently letters to people that have already received a credit, asking them to return it if they believe it was improperly issued. Okay. Now remember, because these people got paid their refund, and because most likely they didn't do that on the original returns, but did it on amended returns, there are definitely a bunch of people that are within the statute of limitations for the IRS to go back and ask for the money back. They have 2 years effectively to do that. So at least 2 years. So even though you may say, wait, unless Congress passes the law that passed the House, we're already past the date. Tough luck, IRS. You can't get 2020 back. Yeah, they probably can if you got it via filing a claim for refund, unless you were paid more than 2 years ago. So you almost certainly, you know, and not many people actually filed it and got paid less than 2 years ago. You know, a lot of these filings started suddenly coming up in 22, right? And remember, 21's rules were way more generous. So 21 year, which is clearly still open, you know, is the year where we're probably going to get the bigger claim, the bigger numbers coming back. And they say, well, the 2020 letters have already begun to be sent out. They're going to start sending out 21 letters here very, very soon. Again, asking for the money back, either because they've now determined flat out that the business didn't qualify. They may have discovered you weren't actually in business, which is a bad thing, or other things may have happened. She noted there was no specific date set to end the moratorium on processing ERC claims that came in play last September. Remember, everything stopped mid-September, including the ads for ERC on the television. Oh, remember that. You know, when the IRS announced they would not be processing for the rest of the year, we are now sitting in May of 24, so well after they stopped processing, and they still have not restarted, and they're not telling us when they would restart. So those both go there. So that's probably not good. Now, the counsel reminded the audience that you can still withdraw a claim, right? But it's not going to be under the voluntary withdrawal program. She suggests that if you really believe your claim's wrong, rather than amending, you should contact the service and look into withdrawal options. To withdraw the claim, return your money. Now, doesn't really go into detail here, but almost certainly I would expect at this point you're not going to get to keep the 20% that you would have had you done it before, you know, late March under the voluntary disclosure program. You know, you're going to pay interest. You're going to pay back the interest you might have got on the refund, and you potentially are facing various penalties. And don't forget, just withdrawal program does not really open you up to the IRS agreeing for no criminal prosecution. So she suggests if you're concerned that You might have a criminal investigation start based on the facts of your case. You may want to consider the IRS General Purpose Voluntary Disclosure Program and coming in under that program, which again, you're not going to get really nice terms like you had during the, you know, during the withdrawal program, the voluntary disclosure withdrawal program. And again, they were nice terms, but one problem you had with it, which a couple of attorneys pointed out to me, and it concerned them, was if you did voluntary withdrawal, there was no guarantee you wouldn't be criminally investigated. So criminal could still be a problem there. That was kind of the downside to it. Now, finally, there were other people on the panel in this session. And James Creech of Baker Tilly US LLP did note that getting records to prove government orders is becoming tougher. So his strong recommendation was that if you haven't already done so, you start working to get those records, somehow get them together. Because the problem is a lot of states, cities, counties are taking that stuff down. They had it posted publicly on a website. But now that everything's over, from their perspective, they're like, you know, filing that away. They're redoing their website so they don't even bother linking that stuff back up. So he's suggesting it's not easy to get all that stuff. So don't just assume if the IRS comes calling that you're going to be able to get those orders. And don't forget that if Congress does pass the bill that passed the House, we're going to have a significantly extended statute of limitations, which means that, yeah, we may need to get them for quite a while. And that was generally suggested by those on the panel, that you need to get clients ready for an extent, potentially a need to retain records for an extended period of time because of this potential extended statute that's still out there, right? If they go for it. Now, I think it's gotten a lot more interesting as to how they're going to pass that. But we still know that in theory, it needs to pass the Senate without changes. So it doesn't have to be brought back to the House floor. It might come back anyway. But, you know, if it doesn't go back to the House floor, there's no changes. Then we may see, at least from my perspective, I'd be surprised to see some litigation over whether Congress could retroactively extend the statute. You know, the statute expired, at least for claims that weren't paid within the last 2 years, at the end, you know, at April 15th of 24 for those claims that would have related to 2020. So I have to see what they do and how it goes. Well, there's more ERC developments this week because we have a lawsuit filed that's going against the IRS to attempt to force them to start processing these claims again. This is a complaint filed in the case of Stenson Tamadon, LLC versus United States et al. It was filed in the United States District Court for the District of Arizona. It was filed on May 14th, 2024. In this case, a tax advisor who was involved in ERC consulting is seeking an injunction requiring the IRS to begin again processing ERC claims. So they're trying to force them to start working on this again. They also seek to bar the IRS from enforcing Notice 2021-20 when the agent denies ERC claims. So what they're saying is, basically, they want to keep the IRS from being able to use that. And as, which we'll talk about the other case here in a second, but as I had with the case in December, I kind of wonder how that would work. Okay, it's invalid, but it's not quite the case we had with the conservation easement issues. Because there, you know, we had to have something happen at the IRS or it wasn't a listed transaction. In this case, even if the IRS had issued no guidance whatsoever, there's still the question of what does the code mean? So I could certainly see that even if you won this case, it might not be terribly meaningful because the IRS will just start copying the justification from the ruling and putting that indirectly rather than simply referencing the ruling. So I don't know it's a difference that's material. I think they're hoping the court would say, nope, you can't use these positions whatsoever. But I have a tough time finding a reason why a court would say that, right? In essence, the court can say, we're not going to give any weight to this because you didn't go through the proper procedures. So we're not going to assume you're right. But we're not going to say you can't argue to persuade us you're right and the taxpayer can argue to persuade us that position is wrong. Right, that's where we're going. So I don't know if this is hoping for an order that goes way beyond that and would bar them from even arguing it because they had done it wrong, or if it's just going to say, which I think is far more likely, that we won't have any presumption of correctness for this position, but the IRS would still be able to argue for the position in court. Now, this is related to that case from December of last year, the case of Southern California Emergency Medicine Inc. versus Werfel, which was filed on December 1st of 2023. That case was a medical practice that got ERC, and they got it via working with this advisor. They filed for it, at least, their claims for refund. And they, of course, filed a claim asking the IRS to be barred from using 2021-20 to disallow them to claim, but did not actually ask the court for a refund. That's always been weird to me as to, well, we want to kill this off. We didn't ask the court to refund us money. So I'm still not sure why you didn't ask them for the money back if you're right. You know, you're suing. The IRS in that case had already denied, so the clock's running on suing for a refund. So why didn't you ask for the money? Even if you're going to figure that maybe you won't get it, the court will say it's too early to make that call, you at least could then say preserved your rights. So that case, weird to me. But they also are arguing that 2021-20 is invalid. Now, the basis for the attack on OS 2021 for each of them is pretty much the same. That the IRS violated the Administrative Procedures Act in issuing this guidance. Remember, we already talked about for the rescheduling marijuana that you're going through a formal process. You're giving 60 days of, you know, where the public can comment on it. And then you turn back around and you take that into consideration and you issue the guidance. That wasn't how Notice 2021-20 came into being. How that really came into being was the vast majority of it was and came directly from an FAQ posted by the IRS in 2020 under the original CARES Act version of the employee retention credit. That was the one where you couldn't claim the credit unless you didn't apply for a PPP loan. Now, at the end of 2020, Congress decided to extend the program into, at that point, the first 6 months of 2021. And to retroactively say you can both get a PPP loan and do this, you just can't count the same wages for both. So they made that clear under the program. So, you know, that's kind of how we got it. So it was 2021-20 is when the IRS decided, well, we're going to have this around for longer, and now it's a little messier. So they formalized, but overwhelmingly what they did was just took those FAQs and dropped them into the notice format. They did issue other notices as we went on during the year, you know, and those also incorporated. But notice 2021-20 is where almost all the meat is. The major guidance outside of this one is probably the no living relative rule that we got late in the process, that the IRS confirmed late in the process. I won't say we got it late in the process because if you've been following me on these podcasts back to when that rule came, when we first got the ERC, especially once we got the version where opened it back up, my position all along had been that there was a no living relative rule. It just mechanically, that's how it works. When you look at the law and you follow its clear language, and clear language beats everything, right? You've got to find some ambiguity, and there is none. You know, you get the no living relative rule under these rules. It may be a dumb rule, but Congress is allowed to pass dumb laws, right? That's not a problem. Congress can pass dumb laws. They couldn't pass dumb laws, we'd lose about half what's on the books. So let's be honest. They can pass dumb laws all they want. You know, and probably at the state level, we could say three quarters, but that's a different problem, right, entirely. You know, states are messier. This one also, though, which is unique about this case, it attacks suspension of processing. Remember, in the case filed in December, that one had already been denied. They don't need processing started on their claim. Their claims have already been denied. Rather, they need to work that side of the equation. This one is now the advisor going to court on their own, looking to get that injunction, right? Looking to get an injunction to force this to happen. Now, it's interesting, and you know, I haven't really read enough details to make sure, but I don't believe the firm was actually claiming that their ERC has been held up. So I do expect we may see the IRS claim first that, hey, they have no standing because, you know, they're not impacted by this. They'll argue, well, they are because of their consulting business. The court will go around that. But it might have been cleaner to have one of their clients bring the case. I think that might have helped get rid of the discussion, right? The other thing I expect the IRS to do is say, well, suspension of processing, tough. You know, you filed a claim for refund. If we don't act on that within 6 months, you have the right to take it straight to district court. And gang, it's pretty much been, it's getting really close to 6 months. So if you filed your claim right at the last instant there in September, so definitely before this is likely to be decided. So I don't see this moving super quick because the other one clearly isn't. You know, you're going to be able to go to district court. So, you know, anybody that had their claim in, you know, that arrived beginning of that date is going to quickly get to the point where they can actually start, you know, filing their claims in district court they want to litigate. Of course, nobody wants to do that. And I'm sure that, the plaintiff in this case would argue that that's unreasonable to force every business to go to district court to get their money. And may arguably be so. But it is true, which the service, I'm sure, will point out, it's not that they don't have relief. They may not like the relief they have, but they do have relief. So we'll see how the courts look at this. It's a little interesting that we haven't really seen them pick up the ball and run quickly with the notice 2120 issue in the other case. We'll just have to keep our eye on this one. And for those of you here in Arizona, this is an Arizona case, right? You notice that. The firm in question is in Arizona. The law firm representing the firm is in Arizona. Actually, their offices are not terribly far from my office. So, you know, we get all these nice things. I go over and see it. Actually, I don't think they really want me to walk in and see it. Little things about privacy for clients is probably somewhat important, but, you know, those things. So, you know, I'm here where this one is going. The other case is going on in the California District Courts in the Central District of California. So that one is not sitting here in Arizona. This one is. And that may also be part of the filing of this one. Maybe the case will move faster with the Arizona judge than it will with the California judge. So we'll take a look, see what happens. Next up, and finally this week, we have a tax court decision. Now, this is an order. It's not a formal memorandum decision or even a summary decision. It's certainly not published. But it is the case of Wendell et al. Versus Commissioner. It was the tax court's docket number 4787-23. This order was issued on May 13th of 2024. And this order relates to the IRS's motion for summary judgment in this case. Now, summary judgment is where we just take the facts before us, right? We assume that the allegations made by the plaintiff, let's say, you know, the allegations made by the taxpayer are true, the non-moving party. So the taxpayer is not the one moving for summary judgment. The IRS is. So we assume all of what they're saying they can prove. If they proved every bit of that, if that in and of itself would not be sufficient to carry the case, then the concept is with summary judgment, the court says, look, doesn't matter. You prove everything you alleged and you still lose the case, right? That's not enough to carry your burden. The IRS is arguing that in this case. And why they're doing it, well, you do it a lot. You know, the IRS does this, so do taxpayers quite a lot, move for summary judgment. Because sometimes the only question is the law, right? Everybody agrees on the facts. So if all the facts are stipulated, then essentially you may argue the law and do those things, but they'll present those arguments in brief. So it may be able to just be decided by the court sitting down with the information in front of them. But in this case, we have a taxpayer who, shall we say, harkens back to the glory days of the tax protest movement. You may remember that. I know the IRS can't call them tax protesters, but I can. So, good. We'll go to that movement, but that's it. This is an anesthesiologist who received a $500,000 W-2 from the medical practice he was employed by. And they had withheld $140,000 worth of taxes from the $500,000. He filed a tax return with his spouse. And they claim that the $500,000 of wages are not income under federal law, and so they ask for the entire amount back. Right? No taxes due, no taxable income, entire amount of withholding back. So now we end up in the tax court over this issue because the IRS is, you know, it appears they actually paid it back, which is bad, but that's pretty easy for it to happen with the IRS in processing season. And then somebody looked at it and like, so then they opened up an exam, they went back, and now they're fighting over getting this money paid. So, you know, the court unfortunately was not impressed with the taxpayers' arguments. They had a ton of them they were trying. They were trying to claim the assessment wasn't valid. They were trying to argue various odd theories that we've seen tax protesters claim for decades and lose on for decades. But a principal one was one that the wages were not income. So they said, you know, they weren't very happy. That one of their arguments was also one that tax protesters have loved for years. The tattered legal argument, the court said, the income tax is unconstitutional, unapportioned direct tax. Well, yeah, the courts had ruled that prior to the 16th Amendment. 16th Amendment got rid of the need for a tax to be apportioned. For a direct tax to be apportioned based on population, if it was an income tax. So while in the Moore case, we're basically going to play on the edges of that and try to see what Supreme Court comes up with that, this case isn't playing on the edges. It's going for the whole thing. So yeah, there is a fundamental difference between the Moore case, which is a relatively reasonable, even I don't think the court will grant it, interpretation that may say, look, the 16th Amendment didn't authorize this, versus this effectively saying the 16th Amendment doesn't exist, or somehow this escapes it. So yeah, the court wasn't really thrilled with that, do we say. So they went back and looked at the law and said, look, under Section 61, gross income is all income from all sources, specifically includes wages paid for services. And the court did not buy that there was an exclusion because this was compensation for services, not wages or cash paid for services. The court said, ah, come on now. You know, right, you know, you want me to buy that one. You know. And now, court didn't buy that. They pointed out that for decades, the courts have rejected these arguments that wages are not income, right? This is nothing new. It's been in the Supreme Court. It's been all over the place. Wages are income. This is a well-established piece of law. And because of that, they impose a frivolous or groundless position penalty under Internal Revenue Code Section 6673A1B. And that's a penalty where you're going to primarily have gone to the tax court, it's presumed, for delay purposes because you didn't raise any argument that has any chance whatsoever of prevailing. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, if we can grant every single fact you claim and you're still going to lose. You're saying that's absolutely frivolous. Now, the courts don't tend to impose this. They do warn a lot about it. They tell them, if you keep coming back here, we're going to do this. But I think the court has finally gotten totally fed up with this anesthesiologist. And so they actually imposed a $5,000 penalty. Now, the section actually allows the penalty to go up to $25,000. So they were taking it a little easy on the guy, only did one-fifth of what they could. But it's hard to say he's getting off, you know, easy, because this little escapade to get that refund money, he's going to have to now pay back that refund money plus a 20% penalty. And that 20% actually related penalty is $26,956.80. Obviously, he's not paying back exactly $140,000. So at the end of the day, this is going to cost him going down this path, in addition to whatever time he lost, because guess what? The time he's spending in court or working up these defenses is not time he's putting people out for surgeries. Right, which he gets paid for. He doesn't get paid to play bad attorney, which is what he's been doing. He gets paid for putting people under. So this was a very expensive detour for him. $31,000 plus probably at least that much, if not significantly more, in lost revenue because of all the time he would have to devote to fighting this bill, to fighting this issue. So yeah, it's not good. And he did do it pro se, so he was representing himself, because you probably would find a lot of attorneys are going to refuse to go near this thing. Largely because, yes, the court can sanction the attorney as well for advancing what the attorney should have told the client was a, you know, basically an argument that had no chance whatsoever. So anyway, we got that this time. This has been the Kernfeld Tax Developments for the week of basically May the 20th, 2024. Kernfeld Tax Developments is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. Ed Zollers. As always, my email address is edzollers@kernfeldtaxdevelopments.com. You also can find that I will be reading the Connect sites for the state societies for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, and Washington, along with Idaho. I keep forgetting Idaho now is on Connects, so I have to specially give them as a different group. So we do have all of those Connect sites. You're a member of any of those societies. You can post, and if I think I can help, I'll try to give a response on the site. Otherwise, we will see you back here next week as we continue through the month of May. Here in Phoenix, we are heading toward our first potentially consecutive days where we clear triple digits. So that's beginning the fun for the summer. And we will shortly start to get to the point where we won't see ones that aren't triple digits until probably, there's a good chance we won't see something not triple digits until September or October. Sometimes we get lucky and get one or two days when it's cold and it's 98 as your high, but still, doesn't always work. So anyway, we look forward to seeing you next week. We'll talk about whatever comes up during that week in the area of federal tax developments.